Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. An idea is the one gift that you can hang on to even after you've given it away. The TED Radio Hour, hosted by Guy Raz, is an hour of new ways to think and create and fresh approaches to old problems. Ready to explore? Dig into the TED Radio Hour podcast. Find it now on iTunes, along with other NPR podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll look at the state of topical comedy as John Oliver prepares to jump from The Daily Show to his own show. Then we'll be engaging in some hijinks of which, to be honest, even I do not know the details. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Audie Cornish, what do you do at NPR?
I am co-host of All Things Considered.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, welcome back to the show. Show, Audie.
Yay.
Thanks for having me here.
We're always so happy to see you.
Yay.
We like to borrow the radio professionals from time to time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it just for the studio space, basically?
Yes.
Otherwise, you will be kicked out of here.
Exactly. We have to have a certain number of radio professionals on the show.
It's not the quotas I'm used to, but I appreciate it.
You teed it up.
Nice. He just left the ball hovering over the net, and all you had to do was
the ball was hovering over the net, and just boom. Okay, so up first this week, John Oliver, who's been appearing on The Daily Show as its senior British correspondent since 2006, is this weekend kicking off his new HBO show, which is called Last Week Tonight, because, that's what you would call it, because it's only once a week. Therefore it deals with the entire week. I should say it's called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, because that seemed logical as well. It's a half-hour show. It will look at the week in current events. And in the trailers for it, they have actually been emphasizing this quality of, we'll be talking about things 5 or 6 days after they happen. So they seem to be embracing it, as opposed to your daily shows and your Colbert reports. So the first thing I wanted to ask, and this went around a little bit as we were discussing this as a potential topic, and I'm going to throw it to Glenn and hope that he forgives me. It is a tricky question. Mm. Is there a difference between topical comedy and political comedy?
Yeah. Topical, I think, ointments. political, I don't. Yeah, I mean, this is a tough question. I certainly think when it comes to topical humor, I mean, there was a time when I was watching both The Stewart Show and The Colbert Show every night when a news item didn't feel finished until I had gotten their take on it. That wasn't that I didn't know how to get my head around it, but it certainly felt like I needed sort of a comment on it at the end of the day. I can't imagine that our parents felt that way about Carson's monologue. I don't think there was this great hunger, but that's not the role he filled. He was more topical. I do think that even though Stewart and Colbert are both commenting on, they would tell you, and they would maintain that they're not just doing political comedy. They are doing comments on the media and how the media covers many of these things in the news. I do think what they both share is a point of view, a discernible point of view, and I think that makes a big difference. If you don't have that point of view, you get something like Mark Russell. You get something like The Capitol Steps, which is those fat cats in Washington.
Sure.
Glenn has this vendetta about The Capitol Steps.
I do have this vendetta against guys. But, mere populism.
Well, it's stuff that's designed to be nonpartisan and thus is just big, fat softballs up the middle.
Exactly. Right. But somebody like Amy Schumer, she is not doing political comedy, but I think she's doing, on her show Inside Amy Schumer, she's doing topical comedy.
Okay. I'm just waving my notes at Glenn where I wrote Amy Schumer.
Right. On her first season.
We did not discuss this in advance.
There's a sketch in her first season where a guy and a girl on a date, the guy confesses to her that he has AIDS, full-blown AIDS, and the humor of the sketch comes from her trying to demonstrate how cool she is with that. And as she gets bigger and bigger and more demonstrative, she gets revealed as a horrible person. So, full-blown AIDS is not like, internet dating's wacky.
Right,
it's not
exactly.
Like, oh, those airline meals. This is dangerous. And yet it feels like it's current. It feels like, again, it feels like there's a point of view.
Yeah. I had written down Amy Schumer as well. And the reference that I had made was a more recent episode, one of the ones from this season, where she played a beautiful tennis player in a sketch where the idea was she was the beautiful tennis player. And then there was this sort of not as attractive lady tennis player who was much better than she was, but who nobody was paying any attention to, and who the commentators, who were guys, seemed to sort of resent for beating her. And it seems to me to be a pretty clear Anna Kournikova rip, because the idea was that the Schumer-Kana, or whatever they called her, was not as good, but nevertheless got all the attention because she was so pretty. Now, Audie, I know that you love to talk about politics and political comedy, but I'm always curious about what people who actually do news
I know, right?
think about watching fake news.
Well, the distinction I was thinking of on this question of topical versus political is, and I'm going to put us in the Wayback Machine right now and go back to Craig Kilborn and his version of The Daily Show, which I watched way back in the day and really loved. And he was doing media criticism in that he was playing a pompous anchorman, pretty boy character.
Very, very different from his other persona.
Well, very different from his other persona. But at the time, this was a new thing to us. But the thing is, he was making fun of that figure and that archetype. And I think that's very different from what Stewart and everyone else has sort of brought to it since, which is to basically like look at the very structure of the way the media does what it does and completely break it apart and say, hey, that looks like a seam right there. Let's rip there, you know. And here's another thing. That doesn't look right either. You know that's not right, and rip that apart.
Right.
And I think that's been super exciting. But also, those shows seem very, very political and rooted in whoever and whatever the comedian's personal politics are.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that people run into sometimes with, especially with Jon Stewart, is that there's a certain disclaiming of political content that I always find a little bit puzzling, because it's obviously there. And so when people sort of bring it up, he has a tendency to kind of say, but I'm doing comedy, as if it can't be comedy and also deeply political. And my sense has been that Stephen Colbert, at least, has been not quite so defensive about, you know, I'm not trying to say anything in my comedy, because I don't know why you wouldn't.
I think as reporters also, we've never understood that. We're like, okay, it's a political show. We get it.
Yeah.
You're being reflexively defensive about being objective. And that's the very thing you're basically saying journalists are like, shouldn't be doing.
Right.
And I've never understood that part of it.
Yeah. Colbert in interviews to me has always seemed a little more forthcoming about his own political perspective, and you know, has referred to himself as a liberal in interviews before, a little bit less of an all-purpose truth teller than Jon Stewart sometimes kind of makes himself out to be. I think I've said this before on the show. I really, really like Jon Stewart, but the Jon Stewart I enjoy least tends to be, you know, Jon Stewart in Network, giving the fat cats what for.
Yeah. I get that.
I do think one of the interesting things about John Oliver's show, and, you know, I saw someone asked a question today, did John Oliver make a mistake, you know, taking this HBO gig instead of, I don't know, being psychic and holding out for Stephen Colbert leaving, because John Oliver would have been a natural to replace Stephen Colbert as Stephen Colbert goes over.
Would it have been more fun, in other words, to have Stephen Colbert's show after he left than to go make a show?
Right, because Stephen Colbert obviously is taking David Letterman's job, and now there is going to be a hole after Jon Stewart, which could have been filled by John Oliver, and John Oliver could have been on the air 5 days a week instead of one. And I think one of the really interesting points that's brought up by that is this idea of, you know, what is the place for 1 half-hour a week of topical/political comedy at a time when a lot of generators of topical/political comedy are spitting things out by the hour instead of by the week.
He is really good at this, though. He has a podcast called The Bugle with his friend Andy Zaltzman, and what they do is once a week they churn through the topical, all the news of the week. But that is a very lo-fi, low-stakes, low-energy, frankly, because they're such good friends. Mm-hmm. This is a big deal. This is going to be much, much different. There's going to be a lot of people who see him who have never seen him before.
Yeah.
It's going to be a challenge. I'm curious to see how he will adapt.
But I mean, there's also a lot of precedent for this sort of thing. I mean, you had That Was the Week That Was, you know, decades ago, where you had a show where the thinkers of the day got together and commented on the news of the week. But in a way, I mean, That Was the Week That Was is many, many, many years ago. And you would think in this day and age, the imperative would be to be a lot quicker on the draw with this stuff.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the fact that you mentioned This Is the Week That Was. Not only was the news cycle was completely different then.
Right.
But I wonder whether, I mean, the comedy cycle was sort of also really different. Because now, and I wonder whether this is something that's really hurt late night monologues, which I think people kind of typically think are the weak part of most mm-hmm. late night shows now, is that, you know, by the time you get to a late night monologue, you've already been on Twitter all day.
Right.
And if you care about comedy, and if you follow comedians who love Twitter, then you've been hearing people attempt to come up with the best joke all day, and instead of sitting around in a writer's room saving it for a monologue where they write 500 jokes and pick their favorites, they've just been tweeting their jokes all day.
Yeah.
So the odds are somebody will get to it, because the comedy cycle sort of changes the same way the news cycle does and the same way everything else does. Like, and I tell this story on myself because it's embarrassing, but this morning I was writing about Mad Men and I wrote this dumb pun headline about Mad Men, and I found myself like racing to publish this piece because I was like, someone else will take my pun and then it will seem like I stole it. If someone else takes my dumb pun before I get to it, it will seem like I stole it. And so everything kind of feels fast, which is not, you know, a new observation, obviously, but I wonder about kind of the relationship between the comedy cycle and the
news
cycle.
Well, was it John Oliver's show who did the viral videos based on the Republican youth outreach? It was, I think it was a pack. Someone put out these kind of videos that was like a guy with horn-rimmed glasses kind of talking about clean energy and sort of why he has a conservative perspective. And Oliver's already put out like a version of these that went totally viral.
So when it comes to energy policy for this country, I'm for everything. Solar, wind, shale gas, oil, panda blood, the elderly, bones of first-generation immigrants rubbed together, whatevs. I'm a Republican because I'm under the impression that lower costs for energy companies will result in savings being passed on to the consumer, which is cray-cray.
That's a good example of how you can get in on these conversations when you have more time. And maybe I'm just saying this because I once upon a time worked on a weekly show which came on Sunday morning, and you had to do last week's news this morning. But it allows you to really kind of polish the humor. And by then, there might be some sort of settled wisdom about what that quote-unquote story was about and the joke on that story, and you can turn that on its head. And I think he has the skills to do that.
Yeah, I think so many comedy enterprises, and I worked at one, The Onion, for 12 years, they're just mills. You are expected to be cranking out a certain amount of content, and there's always, you know, if they've sold out of ad impressions, the first thing they want is more content. And in the time that I was there, you know, we used to spend an entire week painstakingly putting together the exact, like, here are the 20 best headlines out of 1,000 or whatever. And there was just this endless sifting and winnowing and nitpicking over this perfect little newspaper. Of course, it was in print then.
you remember print.
I'm super, super old. And in the time since I left, I've been gone almost 10 years. It is now, you know, there's not really even one set deadline. They're just constantly spitting out new stuff.
Well, this cycle, you can kind of see it happening on South Park. When South Park is in session, I say that like they're the Supreme Court, when they're actually, you know, in the season, they have a week turnaround time. So that's why you see a lot of these episodes commenting on something that just happened. And it seems like magic because it's animation. How could it possibly? Well, it's really cheaply done animation.
Right, exactly.
It's all on the computer.
It's basically a puppet show.
SNL used to be a place where you would check in once a week. And their political sketches tend to be a little bit soft.
Right.
On Weekend Update, you do get a fresher and a more directed political take. Because, again, the show has a point of view. It's sometimes hard to nail it down.
Right.
It's sort of anodyne sardonic, which is what everybody's kind of doing. But yeah, you pick up, depending on who is hosting a Weekend Update, a slightly different take.
But I think you guys are right in that this is reflecting the news business in general. I mean, not to go back to Kilborn again, but I think, you know, Fox actually started up in like 96. I think it's not a coincidence that the kind of humor we're talking about is reflective of the news cycle and like the way the news is presented. I think people want their comedy with that very strong point of view. It's not good enough to make a kind of very broad joke about this befuddled president could be on the drugs, you know.
Right.
It's like, it has to have a very directed point of view.
Yeah.
You need to acknowledge how much of the politics you really understand, and I think that's what we're seeing. And it's seeped into everything. I think every comedian out there who has a show knows that they've got to make some kind of effort.
Well, and part of satirizing the media, you have to stay on top of what the dominant media form is at the time. And not to return everything to The Onion, which tends to be my perspective on things. When it started out, it was largely a parody of the Weekly World News, which would be very relevant today since they've been out of business for quite some time now.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of absurdist, wacky, gigantic, screaming headlines. And in about the mid-90s, it started to parody USA Today. Mm-hmm. Well, USA Today is not the dominant media form to be parodying. And I think The Onion has had a tricky time kind of grasping at exactly how what to satirize.
Well,
what
do you
voice
satirize,
to satirize
when the most trusted news source is The Daily Show? Right. You know what I mean? Like, if your target audience is actually looking to this for their actual news, where do you go with that?
Right. One thing that I wanted to say, because Audie was going back to Craig Kilborn, and one thing I wanted to say about that is that to me, when I look at The Daily Show and Colbert and undoubtedly what John Oliver is doing, one of the really important antecedents to a lot of these is SportsCenter, because that's where Kilborn came from. And that was the first show that I remember that was churning out a news broadcast that was also jokey every night, trying to say, here's what happened today, and throwing some jokes in there and throwing some kind of meta satire about the entire field. Sorry for the pun, the entire field that they were sort of talking about. So if you watched SportsCenter, Kilborn came directly from SportsCenter to The Daily Show. The Daily Show evolved through Stewart. Stewart very much led to Colbert. There's a lot of production DNA that's similar between those. So you kind of have this whole political slash entertainment media way of satirizing culture that really grew out of sports.
Well, just, then maybe we'll get someone who is not white behind the desk, because I think the sports folks have stepped up their game in that respect, and Late Night has not.
That's true.
It's actually true. Going back in time.
Yeah, and there are exceptions to that. Arsenio Hall has a show again.
Yeah, but it's Arsenio Hall.
But that's the thing. It hasn't changed.
I would put us in the Wayback Machine, except it is happening now.
Yeah,
I mean,
true.
They were like, you know, we got to get a guy who's tested. Like, what was the thinking there? I don't know. It just seems like with the news especially, there could be some way to do it. Even with a woman.
Wait, no.
That's crazy talk. Crazy talk.
I heard they can vote now. They could probably read.
They could and they could probably do comedy, I've heard. Anyway, so we will be watching for John Oliver on HBO, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, premiering on HBO this weekend. So, okay, we've reached our second segment, and Glenn is very excited. And the reason Glenn is very excited is that, you know, as you know, if you listen to this show, I occasionally deliver quizzes upon the other folks on the panel.
Great quizzes. Painter perp. Yeah. There's no top of that.
and Glenn kind of said, I'll give the quiz. You are.
As a matter of fact. what's happening? Linda isn't giving a quiz? What? Everything's higgledy-piggledy, up is down. Oh, we're all at sixes and sevens. I can feel this power. I understand. I can feel the control, the power coursing through my veins.
Yeah. Oh, I don't like it.
So what I've done by doing this Audie Cornish is I have neutered Stephen Thompson's competitive advantage, because if you've heard any of these quizzes before, he's all Mr. Bell, I'm inside her head, and I know her so well, and this is blah, 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 and this is your brain, Linda, I understand.
Oh,
neutered, short-circuited.
He does say that. He does have a way of saying that.
Here is, this year is the 75th anniversary of the Caped Crusader, the Dark Knight, the world's greatest detective, Batman. Yes.
Oh, man.
Why was that right?
He first appeared in Detective Comics number 27, which had a cover date, as I'm sure you all know, of May 1939. But actually appeared on newsstands on March 30th, 1939, which means that right now is the month. This is actually the 75th anniversary. If 75 years ago this month you had walked into your local Woolworths, your local Fives and Dimes, and you'd gotten yourself a phosphate and some bicycle clips and some ribbon candy for another dime, you could have shelled out and gotten a copy of Detective Comics number 27. I am writing a book on this character, and I have culled, have scoured 75 years of his fictive life for 12 questions. You will each answer four. That's the way math works. And
I could have gotten that.
I know. Are we verifying your footnotes right now? Is that what you're about to tell me?
And we do have, if we need it, a tie-breaking lightning round.
Oh, wow. We're going to have an actual winner here.
How should we start here? Gosh. Starting with Linda.
All right.
Question number one. How many criminals did Batman kill in his first year of comic book life? We're talking about between May 1939 and May 1940, how many evildoers met their fate at his gloved hands? Was it A, zero? Well, he doesn't kill anybody. He's Batman. That's his whole thing. He doesn't kill people. What are you, nuts? What are you, high? No, nothing.
You're going to make a meal out of this, sucker.
B, one. C, two. D, seven. E, 20.
You put five answers. I always only give four or possibly sometimes three. You have five answers.
Yep. A, zero.
So, zero, one, two,
seven, and 20.
Mm-hmm. One.
The answer is 20.
Oh.
20. He was sort of a sociopath actually. Nicely done.
Can't stand this. This is the worst.
Isn't it great? Oh, this makes me so happy.
This is the worst.
He was actually just a ripoff of The Shadow. He was one of many ripoffs of The Shadow back then, and he did what The Shadow did, which was kill folk a lot. He also killed two vampires, a handful of werewolves, and three mutated man monsters because comics are awesome. Question to Stephen Thompson.
Yes.
In Batman number one, spring 1940, as I'm sure you know, readers were invited to become members of Robin's Regulars. This was a club whose motto was, be a Robin's regular by being regular.
Oh, Lordy.
I don't think it had anything to do with fiber. I think it was just like, what I like about that is like, just be normal. Just for God's sake, be normal. But this club followed a code inspired by the letters of Robin's name.
R-O-B-I-N.
Nicely done. Readiness, obedience, brotherhood, industriousness, and what did the N stand for? Was it A, nerve, B, niftiness, C, neatness, D, nationalism, or E, nipple play?
Some of those are not real answers. Unfair.
Nerve, niftiness, neatness, nationalism, nipple play.
I am torn. Yes, thank you. I am torn between nerve and neatness. And I'm going to say nerve.
The answer is D, nationalism.
No way!
Remember the era.
I always assumed that era only existed in the form of satire.
Yeah, the Ratsies were right around the corner. Okay, Audie Cornish.
Nationalism. Wow.
Throughout the 40s, and especially the 1950s, Batman underwent many bizarre physical transformations. Which of these was not among them?
Okay, you're looking nipple play.
A, rubber Batman. B, alien Batman. C, baby Batman. D, zebra-striped Batman. Or E, genie Batman. Rubber, alien, baby, zebra-striped, or genie?
He was not one of these, which means they actually drew these other things. Like, that was something people were paid for.
Right.
Okay.
I like your who wants to be a millionaire, like talking through.
Yeah.
Like
baby, zebra, genie. I am going to guess the zebra. That just seems hard.
Sorry, it was A, rubber Batman, because that'd be dumb, rubber Batman.
Rubber is like the easiest one to do. Like, he doesn't even have to look different. Like,
all right.
I don't get it.
We'll have a score check. Zero. Good. Okay. Zeros all around.
How long is this show?
Linda Holmes.
This is the worst. We're never doing this again.
Which of the following have Batman and Robin never been shown doing in a comic? Never happens.
So many jokes to be made there.
Nipple play.
You're not far off. A, waking up in bed together. B, sharing a sleeping bag while camping. C, lying naked under sun lamps together. D, Robin sneaking up on Batman in the shower. Or E, relaxing in a rowboat together in a city park at night. Bed, sleeping bag, sun lamps, shower, rowboat. Never happened.
I am going to say the sun lamps.
Unfortunately, the answer is B, sharing a sleeping bag while camping, because that'd be a little weird.
Gosh, this is the worst.
People were doing the sun lamp thing in the 1940s.
Uh-huh. Stephen Thompson.
Yes.
In the 1950s...
I can take the bank right here.
Batman was joined by the mysterious minx known as Batwoman. Mm-hmm. Which of the following was not among her arsenal of ladylike crime-fighting equipment? A, a powder puff of sneezing powder. B, charm bracelet handcuffs. C, sleep-inducing lipstick. D, a hairnet that expanded to snare hapless criminals. Or E, a perfume flask filled with tear gas. Powderpuff handcuffs, lipstick, hairnet, perfume flask.
I am going to say charm bracelet handcuffs.
The answer is C, sleep-inducing lipstick.
Jeez Louise.
He did, in fact, have charm bracelet handcuffs. Jeez. All right, now, Audie, this one.
How's this going so far for everybody?
I just love the fact that people thought paint or perp was really hard.
This one, I'm going to be throwing a lot of information at you.
That was sort of high concept, though.
You had a 50-50 chance at every question. Go ahead.
This one, I'm going to throw a lot of information at you, Audie, so bear down, concentrate. One of the following is the plot of an actual 50s Batman comic.
Okay, so this thing actually happened.
Yes, one of these actually happened.
So the others are all
stuff that didn't.
Okay.
A, Batman dons a series of flamboyantly colored bat costumes in an effort to distract public attention away from Robin. B, Robin quits and takes up with a gang of young street toughs named the Dungarees Delinquents. C, an old rival from Butler School plants evidence implicating Alfred as a communist sympathizer, causing him to be called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. D, Batman finally tracks down the mugger who killed his parents, now an impoverished, guilt-ridden old man, and tearfully forgives him. Or E, on Christmas Day, Batman begins to give off a mysterious odor. Robin finds an egg in his bedsheets, the Batmobile suffers a blown-out tire, and the Joker evades capture. Probably a pithier way to say that, but we're losing it right now. So, I will read them again.
No, I'm going to go. I kept track. I'm going to go with the one about tracking down the people who hurt his father. Yeah.
The answer is A, Batman dons a series of flamboyantly colored bat costumes in an effort to distract public attention away from Robin, who had sprained his arm, you see. So to ensure that nobody understood that Dick Grayson, who had also sprained his arm, was Robin, he had all these colorful costumes. Fuchsia was a periwinkle.
I don't know what's happening.
All right. So the answer again, score check.
So how are we doing? How are we doing?
Zip, zip.
Still tied.
All right. Yeah. I'm looking. Linda Holmes, you can get this.
Can everybody miss me yet?
Positive.
Linda Holmes, during the same time period, Batman was joined in his war on crime by several allies. Which of these was not among them? Not among them. A, Mogo, the Bat Ape. B, Ace, the Bat Hound. C, Squeakers, the Bat Bat. D, Bat Mite. He doesn't have he just goes by Batmite, like Cher, just Batmite. Or E, Midge the Bat Boy. Bat Ape, Bat Hound, Bat Bat, Batmite, or Bat Boy?
Bat Bat.
The answer is Squeakers the Bat Bat!
An insurmountable lead.
Shut it down now.
Linda just has to dribble the ball at half court.
In your face! In your face, Batman!
Now, of course, in the Mighty Mouse universe, there is actually Bat-Bat, but we're not talking about the Mighty Mouse universe. We're talking about the Batman.
Can't believe you're married and I'm not.
Stephen Thompson. Which of the following exclamations was not heard on the 1966-68 Batman television series?
All right.
Never heard. A, holy chutzpah. B, holy guacamole. C, holy holly in the ivy. D, holy priceless collection of Etruscan snoods. Or E, holy oleo.
I always thought the priceless collection of Etruscan snoods was something you said.
You've heard this term before?
No, from Glenn Weldon saying like.
So the only question is, did he get
it
from
Did he
Batman?
Make it up, or is he just quoting something ridiculous?
I'd take the snoods, man.
Chutzpah, guacamole, hot in the ivy, priceless collection of Etruscan snoods, oleo.
I'm going to go with the snoods.
The answer is C, holly in the ivy.
Oh,
priceless collection of Etruscan snood does, in fact, come from the Batman television show. Just as a fun fact.
Well, I should be glad I'm still ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Linda actually tainted the process.
Yes.
So I should just get a point.
And just as a fun fact, which I'm now realizing is only fun to me, when Robin says holy oleo on the show, Catwoman Julie Newmar turns to him and says, I didn't know you could yodel, because that's the best show on television.
Yeah.
It's pretty much.
Yeah,
okay. All right.
My lead remains intact. 1-0.
That's
to
your
zero.
Takeaway.
Okay, Audie Cornish. This is a straight ball down the middle. This is some baseball term. This is you're going to see this coming through the midday snow. This is for you. In 1984, Dick Grayson gave up the role of Robin to assume his own independent crime-fighting identity. Which name did he choose? Was it A, Wingman, B, Nightman, C, Wing Knight, D, Nightwing, or E, Punchy McGee?
It's Punchy McGee.
Wait, so this is one that is the name.
It is
yes.
the name.
It is the name.
Yep.
Yes.
Wingman, Nightman, Wing Knight, Nightwing, or Punchy McGee.
Again, you've described this as some kind of softball to me.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to guess Nightwing.
Exactly. D, Nightwing.
Yeah.
We have a tie.
This is literally the first time where I've made a guess in my head, and it was the right.
Yeah.
Okay, you each have only one more question. It's almost over.
Okay. Coming for you, Holmes. Sorry. This is NPR.
Linda Holmes. In 1988, the fate of Jason Todd, who, as you know, was the second Robin the Boy Wonder, was left up to a call-in vote, so readers could call in and decide whether this kid lived or died. Readers hungering for the kid's death won the day, but how close was the final vote? How many votes separated? A, 4 votes. B, 28 votes. C, 109 votes. D, 1,385 votes. Or E, 22,021 votes.
How would I possibly know the answer to this? This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Four, and what was the second one?
28, 109, 1,385, or 22,021.
28.
The answer is 28.
No! I'm eliminated from contention.
This is like launching one from the halfway. Like, what the heck?
Oh, man.
Well, see, I've designed quizzes, so I know how you design them. It's not the lowest one. It's the next lowest one. But,
Stephen Thompson, you can... Wow. You can
this is just dignity. This is all this is just trying to salvage what...
You're just trying not to get blanked
speck
now.
...speck of dignity remains.
Yep.
Goose-egged. Yep. In 2005, Jason Todd, the second Robin, 17 years after he died, returned from the dead. How did he accomplish this? A... Turns out he had faked his death in an effort to get out from under Batman's thumb. Mm-hmm. B, Batman's enemy Ra's al Ghul revived him by submerging his corpse in one of his famous Lazarus pits. C, a top secret government organization had him cloned. D, Wizard did it. E, Superboy punched the walls of reality really, really hard, causing shockwaves that reverberated through creation and brought him back to life because shut up, that's why.
I mean, I'm going to be wrong. I'm going to go with the cloning.
The answer is Superboy punched the walls of creation really hard, causing shockwaves that reverberated through creation, brought him back to life because shut up, that's why.
Wow. 0-4-4.
Audie Cornish.
This is pitiful, Thompson.
Final
pitiful
question. Showing. Final question. Audie Cornish, Simon & Schuster will soon publish a book examining how the character of Batman has intersected American culture over his 75 years of existence and helped give rise to what some call nerd culture. When will this impressive and fascinating-sounding book called The Caped Crusade by the exciting, charismatic, and thin young writer Glenn Rogan be published? A, summer 2014. B, fall 2014. C, winter 2014. D, spring 2015. Or E, summer 2015.
She just has to get the season. This is terrible. Unfair.
Oh, I should have listened.
Yeah, yeah. Say it's that. A perfect question for Audie.
And you're still writing this book now, you say?
Summer 2014, fall 2014, winter 2014, spring 2015, summer 2015. Boy, the tension in this room.
None of the above because he's not going to finish it.
I know. Is there like a what happens if you don't make the
You might have to revise the record down the line.
Let's say summer... No. One of the 2015s? Well, the spring one?
What's your final answer?
The spring one. This is an excuse for you to say when the book is coming out, so just say it.
Just to clarify, just for the record, you're saying that The Caped Crusade by Glenn Wilder comes out in spring 2015.
Grossest thing I've ever seen.
You are correct. Spring 2015, we have a tie!
Wait, what?
So exciting!
Is right. that really the time?
Yep.
Yeah, you got it right.
But I thought you said the anniversary was now.
Yeah, I know.
So you gotta get going, my friend. Now I really don't have any respect for the length of that quiz.
It's to celebrate the 76th anniversary.
Wait a second.
All right. We will start with Linda and go back and forth. Name every member of Batman's rogues gallery that you can think of. His every villain. We will stop when one of you cannot answer. It can be from any incarnation.
Okay.
But you just must name it within 3 seconds.
Do you have to name it proper?
And you must get the name right. Yes, that's exactly. Oh, so we'll start with Linda Holmes.
I'm done.
Go.
The Joker.
Audie Cornish.
Harley Quinn.
Nice. Linda.
The Riddler.
Audie.
Poison Ivy.
Linda.
The Penguin.
Audie.
I only know girls.
Does Catwoman count?
She does. Linda.
I don't think Catwoman should count. No.
They are adversarial.
Yes, totally in the rogues gallery.
3 seconds.
Can I steal the bank?
What? Wink Martindale.
All right. Audie Cornish, you are the winner of the Bat Quiz.
I only had one more left in my brain, and I don't think the name was right.
What was the name?
The Scarecrow. Dude.
Of course. Yes, absolutely.
I wasn't even close then.
So how does it feel, Linda Holmes? Did you enjoy that? Doesn't seem like you did.
I enjoyed it immensely.
I'm emotionally spent. I mean, that was very involved.
I would have known when your book was coming out, too. Mm-hmm. I just want to say. Mm-hmm. I got questions based on actual knowledge.
And not logic, because the anniversary is now.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, Glenn. And you will never give another quiz.
Last quiz. I mean, really.
Mm-hmm. You will never give another quiz as long as you live.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Can there be guest quizzes? I'll, actually quiz you guys on the news just to drive you crazy.
That would be great.
Doesn't it be like, Sergey Lavrov had this to say?
That would be awesome. But that does bring us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week, other than Glenn's quiz, which made me very happy, despite the fact that I lost. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I was blindsided by an article in the New York Times over the weekend. This is a little bit smarter than the things that usually make me happy. Just a random business story with the headline, "When diamonds are dirt cheap, will they still dazzle?" And I'm like, well, that's interesting. Why would diamonds be dirt cheap? Clicked on the link and read this fascinating kind of not super expansive. It left a lot of things for you to fill in your head. But this story wound up being part business story, part philosophy, part business advice, and part science fiction. Because it's all about how in a future world, they have already devised a way to effectively clone diamonds. And I just found myself just going down a rabbit hole in my own mind of how you would base your investments on this near future world. I mean, Bob Mondello has talked about how much he loves the movie Tim's Vermeer, about how they're able to recreate a painting using technology. And this article gets into that somewhat, that like, if you can have a perfect Picasso that would fool experts in art forgery, what is the value of future art? And it's just this, it took me down this real rabbit hole of like, there's this passage here. Tumbling prices will transform many long-standing social customs. An engagement diamond, for instance, will lose its power as a token of commitment once flawless 2-carat stones can be had for only $25. The author of the piece is a guy named Robert H. Frank, and he speculates that the push for very big-ticket items will shift to things that can't be duplicated. He's like, there can be an almost infinite number of skyscrapers, but a limited number of them would have views of Central Park, and thus you could see real estate prices spiking incredibly as people look for new status symbols that can't be duplicated. I just thought it was fascinating. It kind of turned into this near future science fiction of like how the world will be different once certain technologies take off. I just loved it. I was fascinated by it.
I've never clicked on an article in the business section.
And I feel like I should more often. When diamonds are dirt cheap, will they still dazzle?
So what's making Stephen Thompson happy this week? The end of jewelry.
Yes! Oh my God, that's exactly why.
I know you.
It's just the beginning of another high-ticket item, but I appreciate your enthusiasm.
Audie Cornish, what is making you happy this week?
I have a very selfish and self-involved thing, which is that I had given up TV for Lent. And
wow.
It was a long time, yo. Now, it is not the same commitment as our Lord may have made.
You're supposed to give up, like, I'm giving up white chocolate-covered pretzels.
I know.
You're supposed to give up a minor thing.
Listen, I thought it was minor. I totally was like, I'm going to do this and, you know, I'm...
Read books
and read the Bible and that sort of things, which I did do, but all the things ever ended, and everybody was like, TV was amazing! You know, like, everywhere
it started. Fargo started.
New things started, and it was very weird kind of going through. It actually did feel like I had cut myself out of something culturally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones had started, and True Detective, the entire True Detective phenomenon happened. And it brought me back to my days as a kid when we, like, didn't have cable or, like, TV, really. Mm-hmm. And kids at school would be like, yeah, Transformers were amazing. And I'd be like, I'm sure they were. Like, I know. Uh-huh. I faked it through a couple conversations, reading recaps. But I lived without it, and I was fine. But, yeah, I'm kind of happy to be back now. So yeah. If you see me in the hallways, you can ask me about things, and I will have answers now.
What have you been watching?
I haven't started yet. I'm, like, afraid if I start, I'll binge. Right. And, like, you guys will find my body face down on my couch.
Yeah,
exactly. Just with, like, you know, hot Cheetos and Takis. Everywhere.
Did you set your DVR to capture all the things that...
I didn't. That was another thing.
Wow.
And I'm not going to catch up on those episodes.
It's amazing. It's
shaking my world.
Thank you, Audie. That's very awesome. Glenn Weldon, other than giving the quiz and working on your book, what else is making you happy this week?
There's a Twitter account called Unfinished Scripts. The conceit is that this guy writes a script and then gets so disillusioned because they're so terrible that he can't go past the first page. They are very, very funny. The one that is my favorite right now is one about a group of Navy SEALs. Exterior, remote Pacific Island day, a group of Navy SEALs slowly make their way through the jungle. They all have huge sweaty muscles and big automatic guns. Everyone is nervous. Rodeo, a cowboy-themed SEAL, whispers to Bronx, a New York City-themed SEAL. Rodeo, I'd give half a horse to know what the hell we're doing here. Bronx. Sarge says he'll let us know the mission objective when we need to. Jeez, you're more annoying than a traffic jam on the Brooklyn Bridge. Then Wipeout, a surfer-themed SEAL, once they get surrounded by enemies, says, uh-oh, hang zero. Then later, a pastry chef-themed SEAL named Cupcake says, holy cannoli. And it concludes with Books, a librarian-themed SEAL, leaning over to Monet, an impressionist painter-themed SEAL, and saying, Book says, I think it's time for us to check out.
Wow.
There's got to be a way to escape. And Monet says, yeah, I say we depict the visual impression of the moment with the focus on the effect of light, color, and getting the hell out of here.
Nice.
I love it.
So this would be a series of tweets.
A series of tweets.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Series of tweets. No, actually, this
I am
is
not
all,
skilled at
he
this.
Just takes a shot of his computer screen.
Oh,
and
I
yes,
see.
Yes, they are a series of themed tweets, but they are so good.
Do people reply back with help?
I don't know about that.
Or a desire to be cast.
They are written by Gavin Spieler, S-P-E-I-L-E-R. He also has a Twitter account, but follow Unfinished Scripts, Unfinished S. Very fun.
I like it. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Okay, so believe it or not, what is making me happy this week is a book. A book!
Whoa, look at you.
A novel! Look at me! Not only that, but I'm going to tell you right now, it's a book that's not coming out till August.
Show
this
off.
This is perk of job. But I will say, the last time I did this very same thing, it was a little book called Eleanor and Park,
yep.
which went on to become a fairly prominent book. So I'm just saying, maybe take my early advice. This particular book is what I would describe as the world's angriest epistolary novel. And it is written by a woman named Julie Schumacher, who I did not realize until I looked her up. Grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, went to Oberlin, and now lives in Minnesota, which means she and I have basically been following each other through life up until this point. But she has written several books. This particular novel is called Dear Committee Members. It's the writer is a professor who is working out of the crumbling English building, which is being gradually dismantled and falling apart and spewing out fumes and stuff like that. The book consists of mostly letters of recommendation that he has to write for students, for other faculty who are trying to get various meaningless positions in the university. And it becomes very clear that he is a very, very embittered person and very funny, especially at first. Now, over the course of the book, he becomes a little more frightening, but mostly through a good part of the book, he's just very, very funny and the letters are very funny. And I was going to read a little bit of this one, which is addressed to an associate chair at a community college. It begins, Dear Professor Quam, Alex Ruffel has prevailed upon me to support his teaching application to your department, which I gather is hiring adjunct faculty members exclusively, bypassing the tenure track with its attendant health benefits, job security, and salaries on which a human being might reasonably live. Perhaps your institution should cut to the chase and put its entire curriculum online, thereby sparing Rufel the need to move to Lattimore, wherever that is. You could prop him up in a broom closet in his apartment, poke him with the butt end of a mop when you need him to cough up a lecture on Caribbean fiction or the passive voice, and then charge your students $1,000 each to correct the essays their classmates have downloaded from a website. Such is the future of education. So many of these letters of recommendation, as you may have figured out, do not really wind up being very effective letters of recommendation, as they turn hostile, resentful, self-absorbed. He cannot resist telling long stories about his painful and terrible life. But many epistolary novels, for me, wind up feeling a little bit like a cheat because it's almost like you didn't want to construct the whole story, so it's a bunch of letters. So this book, as I said, does not come out until August. It's really funny. It's really good. It's called Dear Committee Members. And if you have ever been part of academia, I have a feeling it will resonate in the angriest parts of your soul, as a lot of it has to do with the internal politics of academia and universities and departments and chairs. So it is called, again, Dear Committee Members, Julie Schumacher. It is fabulous, and it is not coming out until August. So mark yourself a little note, and I will bug you about it more when it is coming out. But it made me very, very happy because I felt so literate. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Audie at NPR Audie. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Lauren Magaki, at L Magaki, MIGAKI. You can also follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. And for those of you who asked last week, you are tapping your foot to Toxic by Britney Spears at this point, thanks to our also producer, Nick Fountain, who you can follow at Nick Like Nick Fountain Like Fountain. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. An idea is the one gift that you can hang on to even after you've given it away. The TED Radio Hour, hosted by Guy Raz, is an hour of new ways to think and create and fresh approaches to old problems. Ready to explore? Dig into the TED Radio Hour podcast. Find it now on iTunes, along with other NPR podcasts.